He jumped off his booster seat and went to the file cabinet behind his desk.
In the past 3 years, this hospital has had 4 people go AWOL in the middle of the night. No one seems to think that's unusual. Turns out people don't like being here.
He pulled 4 files and handed them over to me.
Read them fast. They're supposed to be confidential.
I flipped through Jeffrey Cubbin and Floyd Dugan. Both men had been accused of crimes and released on a bail bond. They got sick while they were bonded out, went to the hospital, and were never seen again. Didn't show up for court. Never returned home, made any credit card charges, or withdrew money from a bank account. Craig Fish was their surgeon. The third guy was a homeless man who was hit by a car, kept overnight for observation, and disappeared before daybreak. Willie Hernandez disappeared hours after having a kidney stone removed. He'd been arrested for domestic violence and was awaiting trial, and he was in the country illegally. Craig Fish was a surgeon. They all had a reason to disappear, I said, and 3 out of the 4 were operated on by Dr. Fish.
You've heard of lawyers chasing ambulances? He's a medical equivalent. Behind his back, they call him Dr. Stock and Slash, and it's rumored he isn't above removing a healthy appendix if business is slow.
I met him. He seemed nice.
Who said he wasn't nice? Everyone loves him. He's just a little aggressive about acquiring patients.
I gave the files back to Briggs. Thanks for letting me see these. They're all open cases, right?
Right.
And no one ever figured out how the patients left the hospital?
No, I don't think anyone cares a lot. They're gone. End of story.
It's weird.
It could be ingenious. Someone's in the hospital and he's in trouble. He wants to disappear, and some sympathetic nurse or orderly is happy to make it happen for a price.
What about the homeless guy?
I don't know about the homeless guy. He doesn't fit my profile.
So we might have a theory on how 3 out of the 4 got help disappearing, but that doesn't explain why none of these people got caught on a security camera when they left.
I looked at the tapes. I even looked to see if Cubbin could have been disguised as a nurse, but I didn't see anything.
Did you look at any of the other tapes?
They aren't available. The hospital only keeps the tapes for 6 months.
I stood and turned to go. Thanks again.
Don't mention it. And I mean, don't mention it. I'll swear on a Bible I never showed you the files. In fact, I never even talked to you. You weren't here.
Understood. I left Briggs and took the elevator to the 4th floor. I walked past the nurse's station and slowly made my way down the hall, glancing into the rooms. They were standard, semi-private hospital rooms. Privacy curtains, a chair for each bed, hospital tray tables, painted a bilious green and tan. Many of the rooms had only 1 patient. This must be a slow time of the year for you, I said to an aide. A lot of the rooms are only half full.
This is a surgery floor, and most people get sent home same day or next day. It's too expensive to stay longer. Years ago, when the hospital was built, people stayed a week or 2 after surgery.
Were you here when Jeffrey Cubbin disappeared? I read about it in the paper. I guess he decided to leave early.
He was gone when I came in that morning. Everyone was scratching their head, wondering where he could be. No one saw him leave. I guess he didn't want to stand trial.
Did he have a roomie when he was here? She thought for a moment.
No.
I traveled the length of the hall, retraced my steps, and went back to the nurse's station. Is this the only elevator? I asked the aide.
There's a service elevator, but it's not available to visitors, she said.
I went back to Randy Briggs.
Geez, he said. I thought you left.
I have another question. Is it possible Cubbin left via the service elevator?
No, I would have seen him from the hall video. It has a clear shot of the service elevator.
Damn.
Tell me about it. I'm on the job for 2 months and some idiot disappears. Lucky for me, no one seems to care. Except for you. You're a real pain in the ass.
I gave him the finger.
Nice, he said. Very classy.
I left the hospital and drove back to the office. I want to talk to Cubbin's night nurse, I told Connie. Her name is Norma Kruger. Can you get me some information on her? Connie typed the name into one of her search programs, and the information started to pour in. She hit print, and in 30 seconds, I had a 2-page bio. Divorced, no children, 34 years old, owns a condo in a building not far from the hospital. Everything else is blah, 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 no litigation or derogatory comments. I don't see a mortgage or car loan.
Looks like she pays cash, Connie said.
How does she do that on a nurse's salary? Connie shrugged.
Good divorce settlement?
and there's talk she does some recreational substance abuse.
She might have something going on the side, Connie said. Maybe she gives a really good sponge bath and she gets tips.
Maybe the sponge baths are so good, Cubbin followed her home and never left.
That would be convenient.
Connie squinted in the direction of the large plate glass window at the front of the office.
I think someone's trying to break into your car.
I swiveled my head and followed Connie's line of vision. Sure enough, Brody Logan was at work with a crowbar.
It's Logan, I said on the move. He wants Tiki.
I burst out the door, swung my messenger bag, and caught Logan on the side of the head. The crowbar flew out of his hand, and he staggered sideways. I lunged for him, but he jumped away and took off. I didn't bother chasing him. I knew I couldn't catch him.
He's fast, Connie said. Next time you need to zap him.
Connie went back into the office, and I looked the car door over for crowbar damage. Ranger parked behind me and walked over.
What's going on?
Someone tried to break into the Buick.
The Buick is enchanted, Ranger said. It's impervious to damage and breaking and entering. Why would someone want to steal it?
It's a classic.
Besides that.
He was after the Tiki in the back seat. It's sort of his.
I have good news and bad news, Ranger said. What do you want to hear first?
The good news.
Actually, I lied about the good news. It's all bad. Kinsey got another message. This time it was written on his living room wall. He found it when he came home from the hospital.
You didn't get one?
No, I feel neglected.
It would be hard to get to your living room, I said, being that it's in a building more secure than the Pentagon.
You managed to get in.
You allowed me in. Ranger smiled.
I don't have a lot of fun. I can't afford to waste an opportunity.
You threatened to throw me out the window.
I was playing.
You weren't playing when you got in bed next to me.
No, he said. The play ended.
We considered that for a moment, and I thought it best to move on. Is there more bad news? I asked him.
Kinsey and his fiancée are worried the wedding has a bullseye on it.
Good thought. I'd be worried, too.
Glad you understand the problem, because they want to replace one of the bridesmaids with you. They thought it was a good idea to have someone undercover close to the bride.
No. No. I don't want to be a bridesmaid. Been there, done that. I'll have to wear some awful dress, and it won't fit me. And I'll have to do that stupid step, stop, step, stop all the way down the church aisle. And there's the rehearsal dinner.
You'll be on the payroll, Ranger said.
You couldn't pay me enough.
Babe, everyone has a price.
I locked eyes with him. What about you? Do you get to be a bridesmaid too?
I'm the best man.
I was momentarily speechless. Were you always the best man?
Yes.
Holy cats!
Can we get serious, get past the deal with the dress? Kinsey has asked me to help with security for the wedding. As a professional, I agree that it would be a smart move to include you in the bridal party. As someone who is very fond of you and has already gotten you poisoned, I'm not entirely excited about the idea. If you feel uncomfortable doing this for reasons that go beyond the dress, I'll understand. Whether or not you take this assignment has to be your choice.
If I get poisoned again, I want a bonus.
Deal. The wedding is next Saturday.
He handed me a card.
The dress will need to be fitted. Here's the address of the bridal salon. Sooner would be better than later.
A text message came in on his phone. He turned on his heel, got into his Porsche, and drove off. I looked at Tiki in the back seat.
Do not say anything.
I shoved the card into my back pocket and drove to Norma Kruger's condo complex. The two-story faux colonial buildings were originally designed as apartment units. The buildings had been converted to condos when mortgage money was easy to get, and now, in a more difficult economy, I was guessing a lot of the units were being rented out. From what I could tell, each unit had two parking spaces assigned by house number. Most of the spaces were empty. This was a complex of young professionals who were working at this time of day, except for Norma Kruger, who worked the night shift. A red Jaguar convertible occupied Norma's parking space. I pulled in next to the Jag and cut the engine. I walked to the door and rang the bell. Norma Kruger answered with a raised eyebrow, not overjoyed to see me, suspicious of my intent. Possibly I looked like I was selling religion door to door.
What? She asked.
I'd like to talk to you about Jeffrey Cubbin.
Are you a cop?
Bond enforcement. She gave a bark of laughter.
You mean like Dog the Bounty Hunter? Aren't you supposed to be decked out in leather?
We don't all dress like Dog, I said.
How disappointing.
Norma Kruger was pretty in a hard-as-nails dominatrix kind of way. She had shoulder-length, very blonde hair, parted in the middle, tortured into waves, tucked behind her ears. She was wearing jeans and a t-shirt, and she obviously didn't need a bra to keep her boobs in perfect position and looking perky. I'm told you were the night nurse on duty when Cubbin disappeared.
Is this going somewhere?
I'm trying to get a grip on how he got out of the hospital.
You and everyone else. All I know is I saw him at 2 a.m. and he was gone at 6 a.m.
Did you talk to him when you saw him at 2?
No, he was sleeping. I didn't wake him.
People don't just disappear into thin air, I said. How many people were working on that floor between 2 and 6?
Two nurses. Julie Marconi was with me. She was working the other side of the hall.
And she didn't see anything either?
Nope.
I understand Cubbin was Craig Fish's patient.
Almost everyone is Dr. Fish's patient. He keeps busy.
Is he a good doctor?
He hasn't personally operated on me, but I'm told he's excellent.
I gave Norma my card. If you think of anything that might be helpful, I'd appreciate a call.
Sure.
I returned to the Buick and rolled out of the condo complex. That was supremely unhelpful, I said to Tiki. She told me nothing new, and I didn't get any special vibes from her on Craig Fish. This is getting discouraging. Tiki had no words of wisdom, so I thought I might find inspiration in a bottle of wine. Or even better, I could stop at Mexicana Grill on the way home and have a margarita. Free up the old brain cells, right? Halfway through the margarita, I was thinking a second margarita would be great. And I actually was feeling a little amorous, so I called Morelli. Hi there, hot stuff, I said. I'm in a bar, and I want to get you naked.
Exactly. How many drinks have you had?
One, and one more on the way. And I'm going to order nachos, which I'll share if you let me see your underwear.
How could I pass up a deal like that? Where are you?
Mexicana Grill. 10 minutes later, Morelli pulled up next to me and snitched some of my nachos. Hey, I said, you can't have any of those until I get a look. Morelli grinned at me.
You're trashed.
It's all Tiki's fault. He told me to do this.
Who's Tiki?
He's a sacred carving from Hawaii. It's a long story.
And Tiki told you to stop at a bar and get trashed?
Yes. He made it sound like a good idea. Morelli paid my tab, wrapped an arm around me, and hauled me off my bar stool.
Where's Tiki now?
In my car. He wanted to come into the bar with me, but I thought that was too weird. Morelli walked me to my car and looked in at Tiki.
This is the guy who suggested the bar?
I know he looks innocent enough, but he's diabolical.
He's a chunk of wood.
I unlocked the Buick, unbuckled Tiki, and handed him to Morelli. He's also my ticket to Brody Logan. Logan wants Tiki back, so instead of trying to chase down Logan, all I have to do is wait for him to come for Tiki.
Clever. Did Tiki tell you that?
No. I thought of that all by myself. Morelli unlocked his SUV.
We'll pick the Buick up tomorrow morning. Who thought about ripping my clothes off, you or Tiki?
It might have been me. And you still haven't let me look at your underwear. Morelli held the door for me.
As soon as we get in the car.
Do I get to touch things?
Oh, yeah. Touching is encouraged.
Chapter 11. It was Sunday morning, and Morelli and I were at his little kitchen table enjoying a leisurely breakfast of coffee and leftover Chinese takeout. Morelli isn't opposed to sleeping over in my apartment, but truth is, it works better for us to be in his house. My hamster Rex is self-sufficient with his water bottle and cache of food. Bob, not so much. Morelli has a yard for Bob, plus a 25-pound bag of dog kibble. Morelli also has a toaster and food in his refrigerator. Morelli was always the bad boy wild child, and I was always the mostly good girl. Not to say I didn't have my moments in high school, and I for sure was never as good as my sister Valerie. Still, an odd reversal took place when I wasn't looking,
and I now find myself on the short end of maturity and financial stability. I heard Morelli's front door open and close, and then footsteps coming our way. Bob jumped out of his dog bed, ran to the back door, and whined to get out. "I've never seen him do that," I said to Morelli. "He always rushes to see who came in." Morelli stood and let Bob out.
"It's probably Grandma Bella. He's terrified of her."
Bob wasn't the only one terrified of Bella. Everyone was terrified of Bella, including me. She was wacko, making with the evil eye and putting spells on people. Okay, so it was a stretch to think she could make someone break out in boils just by looking at them cockeyed, but there were enough bizarre coincidences to make you want to err on the side of caution and not piss her off. Bella marched into the kitchen. As always, she was wearing a black dress, black stockings, black low-heeled shoes, very old-school Sicily. Her white hair was pulled back into a bun, she wore no makeup, and her eyebrows were thick and black, forming a unibrow. She could have been an extra in a Godfather movie, speaking broken English and using offensive Italian hand gestures. It was as if the longer she lived in the country, the more Sicilian she became. She plunked a casserole down onto the table.
"It's a Sunday. Why are you not at church?" she said to Morelli. "And what is this woman doing here?"
"Having breakfast," he said. "You remember Stephanie."
Bella narrowed her eyes at me.
"Slut! You keeping my grandson from a church?"
"Last time I was in church, it was Christmas Mass," Morelli said.
Bella made the sign of the cross.
"Holy Mother, help him. He good boy, but he weak."
She shook her head.
"All the Morelli men weak."
"Thank you for the casserole," I said.
"I not to give it to you," Bella said. "I make that for my grandson. You eat his casserole and bad thing happen to you. Warts."
She spotted Tiki sitting on the countertop.
"What's this?"
"It's a Hawaiian wood carving," Morelli said.
"You don't have a statue of the Virgin in your house, but you have this silly thing," Bella said. "You know nothing. I give it the eye. I fix it good."
We heard a horn honk from the street.
"Did my mother drive you here?" Morelli asked Bella.
"No, that's Mrs. Giovi. We're going to second mass."
Morelli put his arm around Bella and guided her back through the house to the front door.
"Say hello to Mrs. Giovi for me."
I heard him throw the bolt after Bella left. "Too late to lock the door now," I said when he came back to the kitchen. "You've got a casserole that'll give me warts, and she put the eye on Tiki."
"Too bad about the warts," Morelli said. "The casserole looks pretty good."
There was no way in heck I was touching it. We walked Bob and then got into Morelli's SUV to pick up my car at the Mexicana Grill. "Have you heard any more about Jeffrey Cubbin?" I asked Morelli when he stopped for a light.
"Only that he hasn't surfaced. I don't think he's a priority with Schmidt. He's counting on you to find him."
"That's not a good plan. I'm at a total dead end. I know there's something wrong at the hospital, but I haven't a clue what it is. 4 people have gone missing in the last 3 years. Dr. Fish operated on 3 of them. All mysteriously disappeared in the early morning. All had a reason to want to disappear. Jeffrey Cubbin, Floyd Dugan, and a guy named Hernandez. It's been suggested someone at the hospital might be helping with the disappearance process for a bag of money."
"Not a big payday in medicine anymore," Morelli said. "I could see where that might lead to entrepreneurial activities."
"And there's a giant albino involved. Lula and I went to talk to Cubbin's wife, and this guy jumped out of a closet at us. Lula thought it was a Yeti."
"What did Cubbin's wife say about it?"
"She wasn't home."
"I don't want to hear this. You did B&E on Cubbin's house, didn't you?"
"Actually, I just did E. The door was unlocked."
"That makes all the difference," Morelli said.
"Are you being sarcastic?"
"Yes.
Anyway, it looks to me like Susan Cubbin took off with a bunch of newly purchased surveillance equipment, and this big guy with white hair and 1 blue eye and 1 brown eye was snooping in her house."
"What happened after he jumped out of the closet?"
"He tagged Lula and me with a stun gun, and that was the last we saw of him."
"You got stunned?"
"Yeah, this wasn't one of my better weeks." Morelli swung into the Mexicana Grill lot and parked next to the Buick.
"Do you suppose we could spend some time exploring other employment options for you?"
"Such as?"
"An office job, retail, housewife."
"Is that a proposal?"
"Not entirely. Thought I'd throw it out there to see how it sounded.
I looked at Morelli. Well?
It sounded scary.
Kind of took my breath away, I said.
I'll test drive it again next week and see if it gets more comfortable.
Do you have plans for today? Do you want to go to the beach?
The beach would be good, Morelli said. I'll pick you up in an hour.
I had my bikini on under my shorts and my t-shirt. I had a floppy hat, sunscreen, sunglasses, beach towel, plus all the usual other stuff in my tote bag. My doorbell bonged while I was searching for my flip-flops. I gave up the search and answered the door. You're early, I said to Morelli. And then I realized it wasn't Morelli. It was Brody Logan with a large knife. He jumped into my apartment and I stumbled back.
I want Tiki,
he said. I don't have Tiki, I told him. I left him at a friend's house.
I don't believe you. What's your friend's name?
I'm not telling you.
Tell me, or I'll cut you up into tiny bits.
I don't think so.
I could do it, he said. I have this knife. It's not just any old knife, either. It's a ceremonial knife.
It looks like a butcher's knife.
It used to be a butcher's knife, but now it's a ceremonial knife on account of its being used for a righteous purpose. It's like a holy tool now.
I had my stun gun sitting on my kitchen counter. If I could get Logan to relax his guard and I could get to the stun gun, it would be my holy tool against his holy tool. Logan craned his neck, looking around.
Where's Tiki? I don't see him.
I told you he's not here. How did you get here anyway? And how did you find out where I live?
I Googled you. You're, like, famous. There were all these articles about how you burned down a funeral home and how your apartment got firebombed.
The funeral home was an accident, and technically, I didn't start the fire.
Hey, I can totally relate. Like, I burned down a forest once, and it wasn't my fault. We were just smoking some weed, and next thing, vroom, forest fire.
I took a step back, getting closer to my kitchen. I thought you were homeless, living under the bridge. Did you take a cab here? Do you have a car?
No, man, I didn't take a cab. Cabs cost mucho dinero. I'm saving my money to get Tiki and me back to Hawaii. I stole a car.
Clever, I said. Good thinking. He tapped the side of his head.
This ain't my first rodeo.
I could see the flash of strobe lights projecting from the lot below us. Logan saw it, too.
Whoa, there must be an emergency, Logan said. Like a fire or some old dude had a heart attack?
He moved out of the small foyer into my living room and went to the window, and I grabbed my stun gun.
It's a police car, Logan said, and here comes a second, and they're checking out a car. I bet there's drugs in it. Or maybe it's stolen. Man, this is so cool.
There was a moment of silence.
Uh-oh, he said. That's my car they're looking at. You're going to have to give me a ride back to the bridge.
He turned and faced me, and I lunged at him with the stun gun. He shrieked and slashed at me with a knife. The tip caught me on the arm, and a bright red line instantly appeared from my elbow to my wrist. Logan's eyes went wide.
Oh, jeez, I'm mega sorry. You need, like, a Band-Aid or something.
What I needed was an entire box of Band-Aids. I didn't think the cut was especially deep, but it was long and dripping blood on the carpet. I took my arm into the kitchen and wrapped a bunch of paper towels around it.
Are you going to be okay? Logan asked. Like, should I call 911?
Not necessary, I told him. It's not that deep.
Okay, then, he said. I guess I'll be going.
No, too late. He was out the door and sprinting down the hall. I had the paper towels held in place with elastic bands, and I was looking for my Band-Aids when Morelli walked in.
What the heck? He said. What did you do?
Brody Logan was here looking for his tiki, and he accidentally nicked me with his ceremonial knife.
You've got your entire arm swaddled in paper towels, and there's blood all over your floor.
It was a big nick. Morelli carefully unwrapped my arm, rinsed it off, and patted it dry. He applied first aid ointment and rewrapped the arm in paper towels, since the three Band-Aids I found weren't going to do the job.
We'll stop at the drugstore on the way and get a better bandage, he said. Do you still want to go to the shore?
Of course. I woke up with a slight sunburn and an arm wrapped in surgical gauze. It was Monday, a work day, and Morelli's side of the bed was empty. The room was dark, but there was light shining from the hall. I could smell coffee brewing. I rolled out of bed, got dressed, and shuffled down the stairs and into the kitchen. Morelli was at the little table with his coffee, toast, and cereal, and the morning paper. I kissed him on the top of his head and dropped a slice of bread into the toaster.
"You're up early," he said.
"Lots to do today."
"How's the arm?"
"It feels fine."
"Looks like Ranger was busy last night. An electrical supply warehouse was firebombed. Apparently it was a rangeman account, and one of Ranger's guys was on the scene when it happened and was pretty badly burned."
I took the paper from Morelli and read the article. "This is Robert Kinsey's warehouse. He was my Friday night security assignment."
"Someone's not happy with him,"
Morelli said. "Clearly." I spread strawberry jelly on my toast and poured out a mug of coffee. "I don't know much about it, just that he's worried. He's getting married next Saturday, and Ranger and I will be doing security again." Morelli took his cereal bowl to the sink and rinsed it.
"I have to go. Monday morning meeting."
He unlocked the drawer by the back door, removed his Glock, checked it out, and clipped it onto his belt.
"Try to stay safe."
"Has Bob been out?"
"Bob's done everything he needs to do. Francine Lukacs will be here at noon as usual to walk him."
I finished my breakfast, retrieved my tote bag, and grabbed Tiki. "I'd leave you here," I said to Tiki, "but I'm afraid his Grandma Bella will return and perform a ritual sacrifice, turning you into a pile of ash." Probably it was my imagination, but I swear I felt a shiver run through Tiki. I went to the door, looked out, and realized I didn't have a car. My car was parked in my lot. The sun was barely up. Lula would still be asleep. It would be awkward to ask my father to come get me after a night of guerrilla sex with Morelli. Too far to walk, especially lugging a 3-foot Tiki. I could call Ranger, but that was even more awkward. My phone rang, and I grimaced at the number. Ranger.
"I need to talk to you," he said. "Where are you? Your car is in your lot, but your bag is at Morelli's."
"You have my bag bugged?"
"You didn't know?"
"No."
"Now you know. Where are you?"
"I'm at Morelli's house. I'm stranded." Disconnect. I looked at Tiki. "He's coming," I said. Chapter 12. Tiki and I sat on the front stoop of Morelli's house and waited for Ranger. Lights were on in the house across the street. Morelli wasn't the only one up in his neighborhood. This was a neighborhood of hard-working people. Sleepy-eyed kids were eating breakfast and stuffing their backpacks with favorite things to take to daycare or grandma's house. Adults were organizing and watching the clock. Morelli's neighbors were nurses, clerks at the DMV, line operators at the button factory, plumbers, mechanics, and dental assistants. The houses were modest, cars were economy models, and like the Berg, this was an emerging immigrant neighborhood of multi-generational families. Lots of Italian and Eastern European cultures, a smattering of Russian, some Portuguese, and lately, Hispanic. Ranger's low-slung Porsche 911 eased around the corner and glided to a curbside stop. I scooped Tiki up and wedged him into the small cargo area behind the seats.
"Garage sale?"
Ranger asked, looking at Tiki. I buckled myself in. "It's a Hawaiian wood carving put up for bond. I'm carrying it around because Vinny thinks it encourages bad behavior and doesn't want it in the office." Ranger's attention turned to me.
"How about you? Is it encouraging bad behavior in you?"
"It might be." Ranger's mouth tipped into a smile. "That's an evil smile," I said to him.
"You're at your best when you're a little bad, babe."
I felt a rush of heat, remembering time spent with Ranger. "A distant memory," I said, trying to sound aloof, but pretty sure I wasn't pulling it off. "What did you want to talk to me about?"
"Kinsey's warehouse was firebombed last night."
"I read about it in the paper. The article said one of your men was burned."
"He was inside, checking on an alarm. Whoever fired off the rocket knew he was in there. The rangeman SUV was parked at the door."
"Is your man going to be okay?"
"Yes, it could have been worse. Second-degree burns on his arms. The other burns were superficial."
"Do you have any idea yet who's doing this?"
"No. The code was secret, but it's been years since a unit was disbanded. Someone might have had too much to drink and talked too much. Someone might have shared his life story with a woman and not thought anything of it. My instincts tell me one of the men is involved, but it's not a given fact."
"It's someone clever," I said. "This person knew you were going to be at the dinner, and they knew when your man would be inside the warehouse.
Could it be someone inside Range Man?
It's possible. More likely it's someone who knows how to listen or hack into a system. Everyone in my unit had access to that technology.
Could someone hack into your system?
Not easily.
Ranger swung into my apartment building lot and parked next to the Buick.
Rehearsal and dinner is 7 o'clock on Friday. The wedding is at 4 on Saturday. You need to be careful. It's hard for anyone to get past my security, so there's a possibility this person will go after people close to me who are more vulnerable.
I wrestled Tiki out of the Porsche. Understood. Thanks for the ride. Ranger leaned across the seat and snagged my wrist.
I'm giving you another opportunity to walk away from this.
I can't do that. I can't walk away. I took Tiki to my apartment and set him on the kitchen counter next to Rex. I gave Rex fresh water and hamster food, added a chunk of carrot, and told him I loved him, just in case he was feeling neglected. I took a shower, dressed in clean clothes, and headed out with Tiki. Lula was already at the bonds office when I arrived.
What happened to your arm? She asked.
Freak accident. Nothing serious.
You look annoyed, Lula said. Is Tiki getting you into trouble?
No, Tiki's fine. It's Cubbin.
The disappearing thing is gnawing at me. It's not like he was walking in the woods and disappeared. The guy was in a hospital. There were video cameras. There was limited access. Two nurses were on duty.
How about if one of the nurses sneaked him out?
Lula said. I wouldn't be surprised. I talked to Norma Kruger, and she didn't give me a warm, fuzzy feeling. Problem is, even if Kruger helped him, it doesn't explain how Cubbin got off the surgical floor or why he wasn't picked up on camera. Briggs and the police looked at the tapes.
Kruger could be a magician, and she could have given Cubbin the Cloak of Invisibility,
Lula said.
Harry Potter had one of those. I saw it in the movies.
That would be a long shot, I said to Lula.
Even so, we could go snoop on her,
Lula said. Connie looked up from her computer. And you should try Dottie Luchek again. It's not a high bond, but it would be good to clear it. Her attention shifted to the front window. It's Logan again trying to get into your Buick. Connie grabbed a shotgun from the cabinet behind her. Lula whipped out her Glock, and we all ran to the door. Logan turned, went wide-eyed, and took off. Lula shoved her Glock into the waistband of her spandex skirt.
What we should do is set Tiki out on the sidewalk and give Stephanie a big butterfly net.
I couldn't get excited about the butterfly net, but setting a trap for Logan wasn't a bad idea. I'd think about it after I got Cubbin out of my head. I'm going to do a drive-by on Nurse Norma, I said to Lula.
I'm with you, Lula said. I bet I could tell from looking at her if she had the Cloak of Invisibility.
I unlocked the Buick and got behind the wheel. If we get to talk to her, let's dial back on the Cloak of Invisibility. It's a little out there.
Gotcha. You won't hear anything about it from me. My lips are sealed. I'm locking them shut and throwing away the key.
Good.
No way will I say anything about the Cloak of Invisibility. Even if she brings it up, I'm not joining in the conversation.
Good.
You're going to have to tell me if you want me to say something, because otherwise I'm not saying nothing.
I did a U-turn when there was a break in the traffic. When are you going to start saying nothing?
When we get to her door. I'm saving myself for then.
I turned left at Alden and cut across town. I drove into Kruger's condo complex and crept past her address. The Jag was in the assigned spot. Curtains were drawn.
We going to knock on her door?
Lula asked. I don't think so. She looks shut down. She works a night shift, so she's probably sleeping.
We should come by at night when she's working and see if she's all locked up. You know, just check on everything for her so she don't get robbed.
It would be our civic duty.
Damn skippy, Lula said.
I made a loop around the parking area and noticed a rust-riddled van parked across from Kruger's apartment. A blonde woman was behind the wheel. It was Susan Cubbin. I parked next to the van and got out. Stay here, I said to Lula. I'll only be a minute. I opened the door to the van and stuck my head in. The cat was sleeping next to Susan, and I could see the kitty litter on the floor behind the seat. Hey, I said, what's up?
I'm looking for my jerk husband, that's what's up. What's up with you?
Pretty much the same thing. Why are you parked here?
He's with the nurse. It's the only explanation. I don't know how she got him out of the hospital, but she's got him squirreled away somewhere. Have you seen her? She's probably made her powder room into a sex dungeon.
So you're following her around?
No,
I'm watching her condo. I'm waiting for a sign that he's in there. As soon as I know for sure, I'm going in like gangbusters.
Do you have her condo bugged?
No. I bought some stuff, but I don't know how to use it. It didn't come with instructions.
Susan Cubbin was almost as good at snooping as Dottie Luchek was at hooking, which was to say she was no good at all. Lula and I went to see you yesterday, I said to Susan. The front door was open and there was a big guy with white hair in your house.
A realtor?
I don't think so. He looked more like a maniac.
They're not mutually exclusive, Susan said. I put that piece of junk up for sale. I'm sure it was a realtor.
The cat stood, turned around 3 times, and settled back down. How can you be sure Nurse Norma has your husband on ice here? I asked her. Maybe she has him someplace else.
She doesn't go anywhere else. She works all the time. If she's not here, then she's at the hospital or the clinic. I followed her there the first day. She's at the clinic from 4 p.m. until 6:00.
Is this clinic attached to the hospital?
No, she's moonlighting. It's a private clinic on Dealey Street, and it's called The Clinic. At least it says The Clinic on the sign, but I didn't see any patients going in or out. It might be one of those research places. There are a lot of them on that Route 1 corridor going to Princeton.
I gave her my business card again, and I went back to Lula in the Buick.
Well,
Lula said, it's Susan Cubbin. She's hunkered down looking for her husband and the $5 million. She's got her cat with her and a sleeping bag in the back.
Where's she going potty?
I didn't ask.
That would have been my first question, Lula said. I'm interested in stuff like that.
Have you ever heard of Dealey Street?
No, but I can find it on my cell phone.
Lula tapped the address in, and we watched while the phone searched.
Here it is, Lula said. It's off Route 1. Looks like it's just before Quaker Bridge Mall. Are we going there? We could stop at Quaker Bridge and get one of them big, salty, soft pretzels in a blizzard.
That would be great, I said. And we could get a couple cheeseburgers.
Don't forget the fries.
Do they still make supersize? I need supersize.
Drive faster, Lula said. I'm about to have the big O just thinking about the fries.
I reached the mall in record time, parked, and Lula and I jumped out of the car and ran to the food court. We hit the burger place first, and Lula pulled a wad of money out of her purse.
I want 2 of everything on your menu, she said to the girl behind the counter. And hurry up, because I have to put in my order at Dairy Queen and Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, me too, I said. I want the same. The counter girl stared at us. Am I getting punked?
Say what? Lula said.
Oh, my God, I said to Lula. What are we doing? I grabbed her arm and pulled her away from the counter. We're out of control.
I don't feel out of control, Lula said.
Have you ever ordered everything on a menu before?
Do I have to answer that?
I'm going to the sandwich place, and I'm getting a turkey club.
That don't sound like a lot of fun.
You can eat whatever the heck you want, but I have to get into a bridesmaid dress on Saturday, and I don't want to look like a whale. Lula tagged after me to the sandwich shop.
Who's getting married?
Ranger's client, the same one we did security for last Friday.
So this is a bridesmaid job? You're like a undercover bridesmaid, like in Miss Congeniality. Remember that movie? Sandra Bullock was an FBI agent that they made into a beauty queen. I love that movie.
I got a turkey club and a bottle of water, and Lula got ham and cheese, a bag of chips, and a soda.
I think it was Tiki sitting in your back seat that made us crazy for all that food, Lula said. You might want to think about giving him back to Logan on account of he's going to make us fat.
Tiki fell into the same category for me as Grandma Bella and Catholicism. I couldn't bring myself to be a true believer and have complete faith, but I had fear. There was the irrational possibility of the existence of a power beyond my comprehension. I can't give him back. I need the recovery money.
Yeah, but Tiki might be more trouble than he's worth. Money isn't everything.
The only people who say that are people who have enough money to pay the rent. We finished eating and went back to the Buick and Tiki.
Look at him, Lula said. He's smirking. I know smirking when I see it.
She pulled attitude and leaned into him.
Well, ha-ha on you, because we didn't eat all that food. We had a nutritious meal of a sandwich.
That's telling him, I said. Buckle up and we'll try to find the clinic. Chapter 13. It was the middle of the day, and Route 1 wasn't especially challenging. No gridlock traffic, no nutso drivers weaving in and out of lanes trying to cut 3 minutes off their drive time. No one giving everybody the finger because they had a crapola day at the office. I cruised along, following Lula's directions.
It's coming up, she said. Take the next light and you'll be on Willow, and then turn on to Dealey.
We were in one of the many light industrial complexes that line the highway. Most of the buildings were medical arts, a plumbing supply company, a FedEx facility, and the clinic was off by itself at the end of a cul-de-sac. It was a medium to large two-story stucco building painted a sick green. There were no cars in visitor parking, no lights shining from any of the windows, no signs indicating what sort of clinic it might be. I parked to the far side, and we sat looking at the building. According to Susan Cubbin, Nurse Norma spends 2 hours a day here, I said to Lula.
It's kind of out of the way of the hospital.
I called Connie and gave her the address. See if you can find something called the clinic. 5 minutes later, Connie called back.
It's a private clinic for surgical recovery. Usually that means it's a spa-type facility where wealthy men and women can hang after cosmetic procedures like facelifts and liposuction. Two doctors are listed on staff, Abu Dharmal and Craig Fish.
Anything else? I did a superficial search. Do you want me to go deeper?
Yes, but there's no rush.
I pulled the key out of the ignition. Let's go say hello.
Okay, but if I get one whiff of hospital cooties, I'm out of there.
I walked to the door and looked inside. Small vestibule, dark. The front door was locked. I couldn't see beyond the vestibule.
You sure Nurse Norma comes here? Lula asked. Don't look like nobody's home.
I rang the bell and waited. I rang a second time. Nothing. We walked around the building, but the blinds were drawn, and we couldn't see in any of the windows. An underground garage entrance in the back was sealed off by a roll-down door. There was also a metal fire door in the back. It, too, was locked.
Guess there aren't a lot of ladies getting their fat sucked out today, Lula said. Business doesn't look all that good.
We went back to the car and sat there.
What are we waiting for? Lula asked.
I don't know. I guess I'm waiting for something to happen.
Looks to me like that could take a while.
I'd like to see what's in this building.
You thinking it could be Cubbin? Like they could have him in here hanging by his thumbs until he tells them where he's got the money stashed?
Lula said. It's a possibility.
I bet I could get us in.
Yes, but you'd break something. There's a keypad on the front door. At 4 o'clock, Nurse Norma is going to show up and punch in her code.
And all we have to do is watch and get the code.
I turned the key in the ignition. I'm going to move the car to the next lot so Norma doesn't see it, and then I'm going to come back and find a place where I can see the keypad.
You got binoculars?
Yep. I parked around the corner and left Lula with Tiki. It wasn't quite 2 o'clock, so Lula had time for a nap, and I had time to investigate some of the other buildings in the area and ask about the clinic. I went to FedEx first. I'm looking for the clinic, I said. I was told it was in this park, but I can't find it.
It's all by itself at the end of the street, the woman behind the counter said. If you go out of our lot and turn left and keep going, you'll find it. I've never been in it myself, but they drop off here once in a while.
I'm applying for a job there, and the ad was vague. What kind of a place is it? The ad just said they were looking for a med tech.
I don't know what they do. They won't ship anything for months, and then they'll send out a bunch of cold packs, and that'll be it. Probably they use other shipping companies.
Myron Cryo Industries was the clinic's closest neighbor. Myron was in a large, sleek, black glass cube separated from the clinic by a clump of trees and shrubs. The lobby was high-gloss onyx and polished chrome. The guy working the reception desk was in a suit that had me thinking he moonlighted at a Holiday Inn. I'm supposed to be applying for a job at the clinic, I said to him, but it doesn't seem to be open for business. The front door is locked and no one answers. Did they move or something?
As far as I can tell, that's normal for the clinic. It always looks closed.
Do you know what they do there? It didn't say in the ad.
Dunno. I've never seen anyone go in or go out. Our security guard says sometimes he hears a garage door going up.
I walked to the end of the cul-de-sac where there was another wooded area, and I was able to lose myself in the foliage. I leaned against a tree and waited, suspecting this was wasted effort. Nurse Norma was most likely going to enter through the garage. At 4, Norma's Jag cruised down the street, turned into the private drive at the side of the building, and disappeared around back. I heard the garage door roll up, and I dropped my binoculars back into my messenger bag. So much for this brilliant idea. I stayed in place and watched the building for signs of activity. After 10 minutes, I heard the garage door roll up again, and a black Cadillac Escalade with dark-tinted windows appeared from the back of the building and motored down the street.
I couldn't get a good look at the driver, but I copied the plate and called Connie to trace it. Lula was asleep when I reached the Buick. I rapped on the window to jolt her awake, and she snapped to attention.
"Who? What?" she said.
I slid behind the wheel and cranked the engine over. I wasn't able to get the front door code, but shortly after Norma arrived, I saw an SUV drive away from the building. Norma was replacing someone.
"Did you see who was in the car?"
"No, but I got the plate. Connie's tracing it for me."
"So how are we going to get in this place?"
"There's a mail drop box in the back of the building next to the garage door. It's designed to receive package deliveries. It isn't locked from the outside because no one could possibly get into it. If it isn't locked from the inside, we might be able to shove Briggs in and have him unlock a door for us."
"You think he'd do that?"
"A patient disappeared. That's a major security breach, and Briggs can't even explain how it happened. I'm sure he'd like to solve the mystery."
"I thought he said no. Like, I thought nobody at the hospital cared."
"I don't believe it. They have to care. It's embarrassing. It's bad business. And Briggs is head of security. I mean, how does it look on your resume that you lost a patient?"
"I see your point. Do you think he'll fit?"
"It was a pretty big drop box."
"When are you going to do this?"
"Tonight."
"I'm in," Lula said. "I don't want to miss this."
I stopped at the hospital on the way back to the office. Lula waited in the car, and I ran in to see Briggs.
"Are you nuts?" Briggs said when I explained my plan. "I'm not doing that. And by the way, it's demeaning. How would you like to be stuffed into a drop box?"
"I wouldn't fit," I said. Briggs narrowed his eyes at me.
"I bet I could get you in."
"Let's not get nasty over this. You lost a patient, and I'm offering to help you." Briggs took a moment.
"And you think Cubbin is in the clinic?"
"It's possible."
"Okay, I'll do it. But I swear, if you ever tell anyone you stuffed me into a drop box, I'll shoot you."
"Fine. I'll meet you in the FedEx parking lot at 9 o'clock. I returned to the car and plugged the key into the ignition.
"Well," Lula asked, "what did he say?"
"He's gonna do it."
"Wow, just like that?"
"He said he'd shoot me if I told anyone we stuffed him into a drop box. What's with all this shooting stuff? Have you noticed there's a lot of shooting going on? Something should be done about it."
"Like what?"
"We should stop shooting people. There has to be a better way to solve a problem."
"I guess," Lula said. "But personally, I like shooting someone once in a while. Nothing serious, like maybe just shooting someone in the little toe. I've done that a couple times."
I cut my eyes to the rearview mirror and glanced at Tiki. He was still strapped in, and he looked benign, but I didn't trust him. I thought he might be encouraging thoughts of shooting. Connie was packing up to leave when we got back to the office. "The black Escalade belongs to Abu Dharmal, the second doctor listed at the clinic. Dharmal is 40 years old and has a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Maryland. No medical degree that I could find. He's originally from Somalia. Looks to me like he has a green card, but isn't a U.S. citizen. I could find no address other than the clinic. He taught at college level before settling in at the clinic 4 years ago. No wife or other dependents. He was accused of human trafficking 4 years ago, but was acquitted. Probably why he left academia." Connie handed me the report.
"Maybe Nurse Norma is doing Dr. Dharmal," Lula said.
"She'd have to do him fast," I said. "He left immediately after she got there." "The clinic is even sketchier," Connie said. "It's listed as a medical recovery facility, but that's it. No hours of operation. A phone number that goes directly to voicemail. It's owned by a holding company, France Sunshine Enterprises. France Sunshine is the president. He's also president of FS Financials. Sunshine bought the clinic at auction 4 years ago. Its assessed assets come to just under $500,000. That's not a lot for a viable business." Connie gave me that file as well. "I'm out of here," she said. "There's a glass of wine waiting for me somewhere."
"I'm out of here too," Lula said.
I checked my watch. It was almost 6 o'clock. Too late to try the bridesmaid's dress on for size. I'd have to do it tomorrow. I left the bond's office and drove to my parents' house.
"Just in time for dinner," Grandma said when I strolled into the kitchen.
"That was my plan," I said, setting Tiki onto the kitchen table. My mother was spooning mashed potatoes into a bowl.
"What is that?" she asked. "It looks like a totem pole."
"It's a Hawaiian tiki," I told her. "Vinny took it as security on a bond, and I'm babysitting it because he didn't want it in the office."
"It's cute," Grandma said.
It reminds me of a big tater tot.
I looked over my mother's shoulder. Pot roast? My mother nodded. With mashed potatoes, green beans, and gravy.
And chocolate pudding for dessert, Grandma said.
I set a plate for myself at the table and helped carry the food in. Have you heard any more about Jeffrey Cubbon? I asked Grandma, taking my seat.
Nothing about Cubbon, she said, but there's talk going around that some residents of Cranberry Manor were planning to kidnap him and squeeze some information out about the money.
Do you have names?
Nope, just the rumor. I heard about it at the bakery this morning when I went for coffee cake.
I forked a slab of meat onto my plate. Those people are pretty old. Hard to believe they'd be able to kidnap Cubbon.
They want their money back, Grandma said, and they haven't got a lot to lose. If they get arrested, it's not like they'll spend a lot of years in prison. Most of them have one foot in the grave already.
I helped myself to potatoes. I'll go back to Cranberry Manor tomorrow and dig around, I told Grandma. See if you can get me a name.
You bet, Grandma said. I'm on the job.
Gravy, my father said. I need more gravy.
My mother jumped up and scurried into the kitchen with the gravy boat. At first glance, it would seem that she was waiting on my father, but truth is, she was happy for an opportunity to go to the kitchen to refresh her iced tea. My family doesn't spend a lot of unnecessary time on body functions. We eat, and we leave to do other things. My father has television shows to watch. My mother and my grandmother have dishes to wash and the kitchen to set straight. I helped in the kitchen, and by 7:30, I was on my way. I had Tiki on the seat next to me guarding the bag of leftovers. I called Morelli and asked if he was interested in pot roast and chocolate pudding. He asked if I was delivering the food naked. I said no, and he said he wanted it anyway. He was at the door when I parked. He was in his usual outfit of jeans and t-shirt. He had a 5 o'clock shadow going that was 2 days old, and he looked better than dessert. I handed him the bag of food, he dragged me to him, and he kissed me with an indecent amount of tongue and ass-grabbing. I haven't got a lot of time, I said. I'm meeting Lula at 9.
I can be fast,
Morelli said. Not fast enough. I'm just dropping off. He looked in the bag.
Yum.
You used to say that about me, I told him.
Cupcake, you're still yum, but we've got chocolate pudding here. That's serious competition.
I returned his kiss. Gotta go.
Where are you going?
You don't want to know. Morelli immediately turned from playful boyfriend to serious cop.
Tell me.
I studied him for a moment. It would be good to confide in him and tap into his expertise. He was smart, and he had more experience than I did. Unfortunately, I was about to do something not entirely legal, and I'd compromise his cop ethics if I told him. Not that Morelli didn't sometimes bend his ethics to suit the occasion. It was more that I never knew when he would bend and when he'd handcuff me to the bedpost to keep me from committing a crime. I need to get into a building, I said, and it's locked except for a large drop box for mail.
How large is a drop box?
About as big as Randy Briggs. Morelli's face creased into a grin.
You're kidding.
No.
Why is this building so important?
I think Jeffrey Cubbon might be in there.
You have reasons for thinking this?
Yep.
Then why don't you just break in and announce yourself? You have that privilege as a bail bonds agent.
If he's not in there, I want to be able to snoop around.
I didn't hear any of this, Morelli said, and I want you to call me when you get home.
Deal. Chapter 14. I was the first to get to the FedEx lot. Lula arrived a few minutes after me. Randy Briggs drove up a few minutes after Lula. We all had pen lights and pepper spray. We were all dressed in black, just like in the movies, and we all felt sort of stupid. Okay, maybe not Lula, but definitely Briggs and me. We'll go in Lula's car, I said. We'll park in Myron Cryo's lot and cut through the band of trees. I drove around the cul-de-sac when I first got here, and there are no cars parked in front of the clinic and no lights shining from any of the windows. Lula killed her lights at the entrance to the cryo lot and glided to a stop close to the greenbelt. We all piled out and crept through the trees and shrubs to the blacktop driveway that led to the clinic's underground garage. There was a single light shining over the garage entrance, and there was a light in a room at the far end of the second floor. The drop box was next to the roll-down door. The metal fire door was to the other side of the drop box. I opened the drop box door, clicked my pen light on, and took a look inside. It was going to be a tight fit for Briggs.
"I'm not crazy about this," Briggs said. "What if I get stuck? What if I get caught?"
"If you get caught, just tell them some college kids kidnapped you and put you in the box for fun," Lula said. "Probably happens all the time to you little people."
"I got a gun," Briggs said to Lula. "I could shoot you."
"You don't scare me," Lula said. "My gun's bigger than your gun."
"Oh, yeah?" Briggs said. "Haul it out and we'll see who's got the bigger gun."
"Geez, Louise," I said. "Here we go with the gun stuff again. Stop the gun stuff. There's no gun stuff."
"She don't understand the joys of shooting," Lula said to Briggs.
"She hasn't got enough rage," Briggs said. "She needs more rage."
"You're going to see rage if you don't stop talking and get in the box," I said to Briggs.
"Alley-oop,"
Lula said, lifting Briggs up and sliding him in feet first.
"I don't fit," Briggs said.
"Sure you do," Lula told him. "Just squish down a little."
Lula put her hand on top of Briggs's head, compacted him into the box, and closed the door.
"See," Lula said. "I knew he'd fit."
There was a lot of swearing and banging around inside the box, and then silence. Lula and I waited, staring at the box.
"You think I should open it and look inside?" Lula asked. "If he's dead, I'm not pulling him out. Bad enough I just ran the risk of getting Briggs cooties. I'm not getting dead cooties. They're worse than hospital cooties."
I opened the box and looked inside. Empty.
"I think I hear something," Lula said. "Sounds like he's working at the lock on the door."
My cell phone rang. It was Briggs.
"Hang tight," Briggs said. "I can't reach the deadbolt. I'm going to get something to stand on."
A minute later, Briggs opened the door, and Lula and I scooted into the building. The garage was dimly lit. Two cars were parked in the garage, the black Escalade and a white panel van. We took the stairs to the first floor, and I cautiously poked my head out the door and squinted into a dark hall. "Stay here," I said to Lula and Briggs. "I'm going to investigate." I tiptoed down the hall, looking into empty, unfurnished rooms with ensuite handicap bathrooms. I was thinking that the building had been designed for use as a nursing home, but probably never had any residents. The hall was bisected by a nurse's station, from which a short corridor led to the small lobby and main entrance, and to the far side of the nurse's station were more unused, unfurnished rooms. I retraced my steps and took the stairs to the second floor. The hall was dark, but I could see light spilling from a room on the far side of the center foyer. I'd been nervous as I walked the first floor. The nerves kicked up to heart palpitations and nausea when I stepped into the second floor hall. The rooms on either side of the hall were obviously offices. Two of the offices were furnished and looked like they were being used. I didn't want to take the time to snoop in the offices. The rest of the offices were empty. I crossed the center foyer, held my breath, and opened a door to a fully equipped lab. I assumed this belonged to Dharmal, the biochemist. There were two hospital-type rooms across from the lab. Beds were made. No one in them. No sign that anyone occupied either of the rooms. No personal possessions. No toothbrush in the bathroom. No water glass. I could hear a television droning in the room at the end of the hallway. I swallowed back panic at the knowledge that someone probably was in the room. Cubbin, maybe. More likely, whoever owned the two vehicles in the garage. There were two doors opening onto the television room. Not a normal hospital room, I thought. It was most likely a day room for staff or a rec room for patients who didn't exist. I had one more door to open. It had a numbered keypad on it. No window in the door. I gently pushed against it. Unlocked. I stepped in and flicked my pen light on. I wasn't sure what I was seeing at first. It took me a moment to realize it was an operating room. My experience with operating rooms is little to none, but to my untrained eye, this looked very complete and high-tech. There were cabinets with drugs and syringes, refrigeration units, gas tanks, autoclaves, surgical equipment trays, high-powered lights, a hydraulic table, computers, and a bunch of mysterious machines. I heard a phone ring in the television room, heard a man's voice answer the phone. My heart stopped dead in my chest for a beat, and I started to sweat. I had the pen light in one hand and my phone in the other. Lula and I had done the drill before.
If I opened the line to her, it meant I was screwed. Hard to hear what the man was saying over the noise of the television, but it sounded like a social call. There were no shocked or angry exclamations. I stepped out of the operating room, tiptoed to the first door, and carefully peeked in. It was the Yeti, with his back to me. No one else in the room. I whirled around and speedwalked the length of the hall. I was almost at the stairs when I heard the Yeti yell, "Hey, what the hell? Stop right where you are!" I bolted the last couple steps, ducked into the stairwell, flew down the stairs, and ran past Lula and Briggs. "Time to go," I said to them. I kept running through the garage, out the door, across the driveway to the patch of trees. I could hear Lula and Briggs behind me. We were all breathing heavy when we piled into the Firebird. Lula put the car in gear.